Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here tonight with Lance, and joined via Skype by criminologist Liz Yardley, also the host of the very popular podcast Crime Bites. How's it going, Liz?
It's going great, thanks. How are you two?
Doing wonderful. It's great to have you back on. The last time you were, we spoke to you on our show, you were with Professor David Wilson, and you gave us a lot of insight into this, the wound culture and web sleuthing. And since then, you've gone on to, you joined up with, these are three other professors at Birmingham City University in the UK.
Yeah, there's quite a few of us involved in it. So I started doing Crime Bites back in February this year, and it was just me and a couple of other people. So it was me and Professor David Wilson and whoever else wanted to get involved, really. But since then, it's really grown. So we've got some regular faces on the podcast. So there's myself, there's David, there's our colleague, Dr. Adam Lines, who specializes in homicide and violent crime. So he looks at serial killers. We have another colleague, Emma Kelly, who runs the criminology program at Birmingham City University. And we have our colleague, Dr. Victoria Silverwood, who joined us probably about 6 months ago on the podcast. So yeah, we've got some regular faces. And I always like to try and talk to criminologists at other universities as well, in the UK and in the US. So we spoke to Dr. Travis Linneman of the University of East Kentucky about his research on meth. And we've talked to lots of other different people. So it's a really interesting thing to do. And I've learned so much more about criminology than I knew before, because as academics, we have a tendency to sort of stay in our own little corner. So I study homicide and violent crime, and I study the research around that and the cases around that, and often didn't look very much outside of that. But it's exposed me to a whole other world of criminology, too. So it's been a really good journey.
Great. And Lance, you were talking about Liz and David's appearance on Missing Maura Murray, which is actually our other podcast. This is Crawl Space, of course. But Liz was on Crawl Space several months ago talking about Crime Bites. So if you do want to hear Liz and David talk about the wound culture that is on our Missing Maura Murray feed. So tell us a little bit about this paper that you wrote. What's the deal with web sleuthing, news media representations of amateur detectives in network spaces?
Well, we've been coming across citizen detectives, web sleuths in a lot of the cases that we'd become interested in. And we wanted to see, well, is there any academic research about web sleuths? Is anybody actually looking at this group of people, these communities of people? And we went and we looked to see, well, what research is there out there about this? And there wasn't very much at all, really. And the stuff that was out there tended to look at web sleuthing around particular types of crime. So there was quite a bit about online predators, so sexual offending, that kind of thing, the paedophiles, and investigating those particular types of offences, especially around paedophile hunters. This was one of the concepts that we've come across in recent years in criminology, of individuals who go online pretending to be children and basically luring in people who would sexually offend against children, and then giving those people's details to the authorities. So there was a bit of research around that. There was also some research around terrorism and looking into the case of the Boston Marathon bombing. There was quite a lot of web sleuth activity around that, but that was one of the cases that gave web sleuths a bit of a bad press, because the identification of people who had nothing to do with that particular incident, and the kind of naming and shaming of people on social media, was something that was seen in quite negative terms. So we wanted to look outside of that, because we'd been interested in cases of homicide, cases of missing people, and we wanted to see, well, what web sleuth activity was going on around that and what research has been done. And there wasn't very much research at all. So we thought, let's start having a look at this. And as criminologists who are interested in the media, that was the place where we wanted to begin. So most people will get their information about crime from the media, and specifically the news media. So we wanted to see what was going on in the news media. What were the news media making of web sleuths? What kind of cases were they talking about? And how were web sleuths being presented to the rest of the world? So we set out to look at newspaper coverage of web sleuths, and we identified quite a lot of different articles, different stories, and that went back to 1998. So the press have been talking about web sleuths for an incredibly long time, and we started trawling through some of that coverage.
So how do you get the analytics of that? How do you break that down, and do you divide it up amongst your team and you say you look for these certain keywords and I will look for these certain keywords, and then how do you get the breakdown of what percentage the searches are? If that question makes any sense.
Well, essentially, we get the body of all of the articles that we find. So we get it all in a massive, long, big PDF document. And we'll individually go through, read absolutely everything that's been written, and come up with themes, identify some of the key things that are coming up. We do that individually, and then we all get together to discuss what we found, and then we just sit down and kind of hammer it out and say, well, what do we think these themes are, until we get to a point where we agree on the key findings that are coming out from it. So, and often we'll go back to the sample of articles that we've looked at and read it again in light of what our colleagues have said in our discussions. So it's quite a kind of intense process, and all the time we're drawing on criminological concepts that we use in our everyday work. So things like wound culture, like we've discussed before, looking at the general kind of zeitgeist, what are the things that people are concerned and worried about in today's society, how is that coming out in some of these articles about web sleuths. So it's quite an in-depth and a lengthy process, but it was a really, really interesting one.
And how long did it take you, this article that you authored, how long did it take you to put this together and to the point where you felt confident to put it out there?
Between kind of starting the research, initially having the idea for it, and then submitting it to a journal, it was probably about 4 or 5 months. And the kind of tail end of that happened over a sort of holiday period where we're not teaching and where we're not kind of, you know, up to our ears in student queries and that kind of thing. So had we have done it during term time, it would have taken a bit longer.
You just can't help yourself, can you, Liz?
Seriously.
No. Well, this is we do David Wilson and I have this conversation all of the time, that we have this tendency to get obsessed with our particular research projects in the same way that web sleuths talk about getting obsessed with cases. And once we're in the midst of writing an article or researching an article, we literally just tunnel vision, completely focus on that, and that's great because we've got quite a significant output in terms of the number of articles that we've produced, the number of research projects that we've done, but we do tend to get very absorbed in things and go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you have an outlet too, which allows a lot of people to consume your work, so at least you know it's not falling on deaf ears. What does your husband think of when you get obsessed? I mean, that's one question we ask people about the Moira Murray case when they're wrapped up. Yeah, what is your spouse
think?
Yeah,
he kind of rolls his eyes and goes, oh, here we go again. I'm going to hear about nothing but this for about the next 6 months. So yeah, he's gotten used to it, and he does provide me with quite a bit of useful feedback because he works in a completely different area to the one that I work in. So he works in the accountancy world, which is a very, very different kind of beast. But yeah, it's good. He gives me some objective feedback sometimes, which sometimes I appreciate, and other times I go, no.
Right. And it looks like, so one of your graphs here, it says 52% of the articles about web sleuthing were written in the UK, as opposed to only 20% in the US and about 12% in Canada. What does that tell you?
Well, it was really interesting because we were looking at newspapers from across the world. So the database that we've got access to covers sort of national newspapers across the world. And one thing that we found really interesting was most of the cases that were being discussed in these papers were from the US. They were US cases, but the newspapers came from all over the world and mainly from the UK and places like that. So we have this kind of bank of cases that are being discussed by the news media as having web sleuth activity around them, but they're being discussed in different countries. So an awful lot of the material for web sleuths seems to be US cases, and I found that really interesting. And there might be several reasons for that. We know that a lot of true crime output, true crime programs and documentaries originate in the US, so they're more visible, that the cases are more well known perhaps than cases from other countries. But also the phenomenon of web sleuthing seems to be born in the USA. So websleuths.com, that was established in 1996, specifically in the early days to look at the JonBenet Ramsey case. So it's really interesting how that's developed.
The section of the article between pages, I think 7 and 21, are all graphs and pie charts, and that was extremely exciting for me to
We love
look
a
at.
good pie chart.
Yeah, I love several good pie charts.
Lance loves pie.
I do a good pie chart. The types of cases are interesting. You have I think it's figure four. It's page 12, figure four, the types of cases. Can you elaborate on that? Missing people, terrorism. You kind of touched on it with the Boston bombing, and then you have homicide with the JonBenet Ramsey case. What were your findings here?
Well, essentially, the articles that we found in terms of the cases that they were referring to, a lot of them were referring to homicide and violent crime. And this wasn't particularly surprising to us because we know that the news media tend to overrepresent homicide and violent crime, even though when you look at crime statistics and when you look at what we know about crime as criminologists, the vast majority of crimes that happen are property crimes, they're drugs offences, they're not kind of grisly murders, but you'd think that they were if you just solely went on what the news media told us about crime. But yeah, lots and lots of articles talking about web sleuths being involved in investigating homicides, missing persons cases. But also, there was quite a few web sleuths looking into other types of crime as well. So property crimes. A lot of web sleuths were operating kind of solo on their own in order to track down things like their own stolen property, which we found really interesting. And also another aspect of this was that the tone of the articles. So the articles, when they talked about web sleuths looking into homicides and looking into violent crimes, tended to be quite critical of web sleuths, saying, you know, things like, oh, you know, perhaps leave this to the experts. It's not a good idea to get involved in investigating this type of crime. But when they were talking about people investigating property crimes and burglaries and thefts and things like that, they seemed to be much more upbeat and much more positive. So it was almost as if it's okay to kind of take the law into your own hands and investigate your own crime when it's a property crime, when somebody's nicked your bike or your stroller or whatever, but not so much in terms of violent crime. So that was really interesting for us.
Do you think that's because the resources that law enforcement have, they want to allocate those more towards the, I don't want to say the more important crimes, but if your bike was stolen, or this elderly lady was robbed during I mean, was murdered during a robbery, you know, they obviously want to put forth more, they want to more resources towards that. So do you think that's where they welcome it, and it's sort of an invisible line, sort of like, sure, with a wink, like you can do it, but know your boundaries.
It is really interesting because if we think about the current context, especially in the UK, we are living in times of austerity and we've had quite significant cuts to policing budgets here. That brings into to the debate for us, you know, what role are citizen detectives playing and what role could they potentially be playing? And we know that when our current Prime Minister Theresa May was Home Secretary, she put forth a proposal for police support volunteers, for people to come and willingly give up their time to help investigate particular elements of crime. So people who were specialists in computing, in accountancy, those types of fields. So there's definitely an appetite there, I think, for citizens to get involved in the investigation of crime. And I think this is going to be an issue that's not going to go away. I think we're going to see quite a lot of this. And as somebody who's interested in missing persons cases, the amount of research that people can do when they commit themselves to these particular cases is immense. It really is. So I think there's a conversation to be had there.
And speaking of the conversations to be had, the other pie chart that I liked was where these conversations are being referenced, what social network they're being mentioned on. Was there any surprise there for you when you looked at it? Because we're actually looking at it right now, and it's funny to see. It's funny to see MySpace on there at a 1.4%. But eBay, I'm assuming that's something that is, if you had stolen property, they're trying to sell it on eBay. Tell us about any surprises you had in your research into this.
Well, when we looked at the spaces that people were web sleuthing in, I think we approached this research thinking, oh, well, it'll be places like websleuths.com and specific sites that are set up for people to engage in this kind of activity. But they were web sleuthing all over the internet. People were using spaces like Facebook and Twitter and back in the day MySpace, but they were also looking on eBay and Gumtree and investigating crimes in those places as well. So it was happening all over, you know, as well as those specific sites and blogs set up to look at particular cases. It's happening in places where you perhaps wouldn't expect to see it, but people are really in every corner of the internet investigating crime.
Yeah, Google is one of them. It says 5.7% of the conversations you found were held on Google.
That was them using Google in the course of their okay. investigations. So I should imagine that many people, when they're starting to look into a case, that's where they first go. Let's just see generally what's out there, what's Wikipedia saying about this, you know, what are some of the news sites saying about it. So it will be interesting when we look further into web sleuthing to see what particular pathways people take in terms of the crimes that they look at. So do they start off looking at Google and then make their way to the more specific areas of the internet and what happens there? So we've only just scratched the surface, and I'm really fascinated to see how they make use of space in more detail.
Right. I almost feel like that Google number should be higher than 5.7. I feel like that's low. I feel like a lot of your web sleuthing should start on Google. I mean, obviously it goes other places,
I thought so too. And I think perhaps what might be happening there is that some of the later newspaper articles we were looking at had almost sort of taken Google for granted. So when we talk about researching things on the internet now, we don't kind of go out of our way to say, oh yeah, I started, you know, with Google, because it's just kind of, it's become part and parcel of everyday life, so much so that it's not even perhaps mentioned anymore when people talk about this phenomenon.
Right.
It's a fascinating tunnel that you're going down, you know, and you're looking at the inner workings of how this this web sleuthing is coming together. It's really fascinating to actually look at the percentage of outlets and the percentage of you know the demographic and where people are looking and how they're looking and how they're searching. I could only imagine looking into, say, Scotland Yard back in the day and going into their like file cabinets to figure out any sort of detective process. I mean, I feel like it's like you said, that you're only scratching the surface on this, and it's a whole ocean of information that is coming out of it. But it's also, well, how is it, where is it coming from, and how are you pulling this information? It's crazy. It's crazy. Like, we just talked about the Google thing. And it strikes me maybe the Google number is so low because people have the information delivered to them on their news feed on their phone, so they don't really have to go to Google. They'll just go to Reddit and start posting.
Right. No, I think they like conversing, kind of finding that information through other posts and then investigating that poster a little bit, which doesn't really involve Google. One thing I love Google for, real quick, is reverse Google searching an image. Lance, that's something we've used a lot. Yeah, that's a big tool, a great tool for web sleuths, especially in what we do with Missing Maura Murray, because occasionally there'll be a picture that pops up and it's like, oh, could this be Maura? And then you just throw it in the reverse Google search like, no, it's this lady from this article that was written back in 2015, you know, or something like that. Yeah.
Or you get something totally opposite and it's hilarious.
Well, yeah, it's usually not what you're expecting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I first discovered the reverse image search when I used to watch Catfish, the MTV series.
Yes.
And I think I first started watching that because I was interested in this idea of kind of people pretending to be people who they weren't on the internet. And it's a really useful little tool, isn't it, that reverse image search?
It is. Can you talk a little bit more about that, what you just mentioned, about people kind of pretending to be what they're not? Is that something?
Yeah, so when I first started looking into how the internet is used in relation to crime, especially violent crime, I started looking at the academic literature on that. And around about 10 or 15 years ago, academics were looking at this idea of online predators because there was a bit of a kind of panic in society at the time because the internet was becoming increasingly available in people's homes, you know, on home computers. And whenever we have a new kind of invasive technology like that, the first thing that people often start to worry about is the impact of that on children, you know, that the corruption of children. And this is a theme that goes way back. So even looking at some of the early true crime comics and magazines, people were really kind of freaking out. Oh, my goodness, what if children read this? It's going to morally corrupt them. And we saw that theme come back in when home computing really took off in sort of the mid to late 90s and into the early 2000s. So this idea of the online predator, that the person kind of out there pretending to be someone who they're not to lure in vulnerable children. And we do have cases like that. We do have people who are pretending to be someone they are not in order to kind of ingratiate themselves with other people. But on the whole, that is quite it's quite a small issue in terms of numbers. So Professor David Wilson and I, we did, just going off on a bit of a tangent, we did some research into the phenomenon of Facebook murder, as we called it. So cases of homicide in which Facebook kind of appears in some form or another. And we started off doing this piece of research, trying to say, well, how do people use Facebook in relation to homicide? Is it all about luring unsuspecting victims? And actually, it wasn't. People were using social media in relation to homicide in very much the same way that we use it in our day-to-day lives. So when we had homicide cases in which Facebook had been involved, it wasn't strangers kind of luring people online. It was often used within existing relationships. These homicides were amongst people who were already known to one another, and Facebook had played a very different role in that crime to the one that we expected it to do. So we came across quite a few cases where there was sort of domestic abuse, domestic violence in a relationship, and the perpetrator had been using Facebook to essentially see what their partner was up to and to monitor what they were doing and as a tool for control in that relationship. In other cases where we had homicide in between groups of young men, it was often sort of used antagonistically. They'd be kind of sort of facing off with each other on social media, and that would escalate to kind of face-to-face violence. So we've always got paranoia about predators, about online predators, about the vulnerability of children. But when we look at those cases in the grand scheme of things, they are still quite small in number. So I think Stranger Danger, it does take on a bit of a new lease of life in the age of the internet, but it's not so significantly huge that we should be unduly worried about it.
Right. It's almost like I hate to use the term, but the collateral damage of having the internet, of having Facebook, Twitter. You know, you look at the good that this has done. I mean, Twitter and Facebook help countries like form revolutions, you know, and help them, you know, form democracies. And then you have other situations where people use it just to stalk ex-boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, perhaps try to figure out their locations and their, you know, private habits. So is a trade-off worth it in your opinion, or is it just inevitable that this is going to be out there?
I think it's really interesting when we look at the role of the internet, especially when we look at violent crime, because the internet and social media, it hasn't changed the world in any fundamental sense, but it's changed our sense of being in the world. So we perhaps think that we are closer to people than we actually are. We perhaps feel that relationships develop more quickly than they used to. Our sense of proximity, our sense of closeness to other people has sort of changed a little bit. And I think we're still finding our way in terms of those values and those rules of behavior in terms of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And often we've got different cultures coming together. So you've got everybody all over the world using the internet, and some people come from very kind of traditional backgrounds, and their ideas about relationships and friendships are very different from other people's. So we're still finding our way with that, because the internet's only really been with us, you know, for 20 years or so on a grand scale in everybody's lives. And it takes time to figure out, yeah, how do you negotiate that amongst the people that you're connected to.
And another graph here shows group web sleuthing as 56% as opposed to 44% as solo web sleuths. I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, we do know people, groups of people who search together. Obviously, we would be in that group portion of the pie chart. But I find that interesting. What'd you make of that?
Yeah, well, when we set out, we kind of thought that people would be doing this in different ways, depending on what they were trying to get out of it. But yeah, so we came across people who were web sleuthing in groups. So they were part of an online community that was gathering around a particular website or a Facebook page. And then we came across people who were doing it on their own. And that was often to investigate crimes that they'd been a victim of, or just to follow their own curiosity. But we came across kind of two other subgroups as well. So as well as the group web sleuthing and the solo web sleuthing, we had people doing it in an organized fashion and people who were doing it more spontaneously. So you had these communities who were very kind of organized. They've been going for many years, and it was a very kind of structured way of doing web sleuthing. They often had rules and that they belonged to a forum where there was a code of conduct. So it was kind of organized. But then on the other hand, you had these spontaneous communities that kind of sprung up overnight in relation to a particular crime or a particular incident, like the Find the Boston Bombers subreddit. And they were much more okay. They weren't here yesterday, but they're here today. And the kind of the people who were involved didn't necessarily know one another. And because it sprung up overnight, it was very difficult for those values and those rules and those norms to be established. And I think that's partly responsible for the chaos that erupted around that particular subreddit.
Which is really what's one of the more fascinating parts about this article, is how you start off like showing us group versus solo, and that's an interesting statistic. But then you further go into the fabric of it, and now it's solo organized, solo spontaneous, group organized, group spontaneous. Is there, because that's really fascinating to see how that breaks down. Is there a breakdown that you've looked into that is when a group or a solo starts off as spontaneous and then they continue on in a more organized fashion, or is that almost like too, is that like too minute to figure out?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to get an idea of that because we were looking at the newspaper coverage essentially for this piece of research. So we're only able to look on a very kind of surface level. And we need to remember we are looking at web sleuths who are newsworthy. So these are cases that have actually made the press. But that's what we want to do going forward is look in much more detail at what's going on. So we've got these categories, we've got these sort of initial typologies, these initial ideas of what people might be doing around web sleuthing. And now what we want to do is actually look in more depth at this. So this will be our next research project where we're talking to web sleuths themselves, we're launching an online survey that people can fill in and tell us about their own activities. So and we think this is going to be a much kind of longer term project to really understand who web sleuths are and what they do and what drives them and the kind of evolution of a web sleuth. So when you first start off getting involved in this type of thing, do you stay in one particular group that you start off with? Do you stick to a particular case, or do you kind of move around and look at different things? And we want to really want to capture the essence of that really.
What about reporting findings to law enforcement? How often does that happen from web sleuths? And what is the relationship like? I feel like this is a topic I'd like to get into a little bit.
Yeah, so we were looking at the kind of things that web sleuths were doing, the sorts of activities that were being mentioned in the press coverage about them. And they were doing a whole host of different things. So they were researching cases, they were discussing cases with each other. Sometimes they were sharing documents, they were analyzing things together, putting like a video up on a website, for example, and everybody chipping in as to what was going on here and what can we learn about the case from this. There were some other activities reported as well. So often people were identifying suspects and trying to engage with suspects, trying to engage with victims and that type of thing. In a few cases, the newspaper coverage talked about doxing as well, so releasing the personal details of people connected to cases, and reporting the findings to law enforcement were just one of the activities that we came across web sleuths doing as well. So I think there are about 20 or so different things that people do in terms of web sleuthing, different types of activities, and reporting the findings to law enforcement was just one of them. But in terms of the relationship between the criminal justice system and web sleuths, it was a really mixed bag. So we came across a few cases where law enforcement were quoted in the press coverage as saying to web sleuths, "Well, thank you so much for helping us with this because this helped us solve the case, and we really appreciate your involvement." And often that was in relation to property crimes, so burglaries and stolen goods and that kind of thing. So the police were very kind of congratulatory sometimes in cases like that. But in other cases, their tone was incredibly cautionary. It was, "Well, you need to make sure that you don't compromise the integrity of the investigation. You need to make sure that you report things to the police and don't go and kind of discuss them on social media." So there is, I think, a sense of unease, I think, in that relationship between web sleuths and criminal justice. And this is something that we've spoken about before, isn't it? It's knowing, it's appreciating what an actual criminal investigation looks like and some of the standards and ethics that need to be upheld around an investigation. But at the same time, web sleuths often feeling, "Well, I've put all of this effort into finding this piece of information or coming to this conclusion, and I feel like entitled, I feel like I deserve to be in the loop as to what the police do with it." But often it's not a case of the police not appreciating what web sleuths are doing. It's a case of them trying to protect an investigation and a future prosecution.
Well said. I mean,
Yeah.
we do get a lot of comments and people reaching out and saying it's suspicious that they don't hear back when they've submitted something to a particular division of law enforcement, and they have to understand that they need to protect the case if it's a criminal investigation, which yeah,
Yeah, it's not suspicious. It's just typical if they don't get back to
it'd be more suspicious if they did. If
you.
they go back to you and said, "Oh, the DNA matches this person."
Well, that's web sleuthing.
That is web sleuthing.
And I think this is part of the issue that we have around this. So We've got a really vibrant true crime genre that people watch on television. They read the books, they watch the films, and that they're really often thinking that they know that the way a police investigation goes, and that they know all the ins and outs of it. But actually, the kind of access that we get to investigations through true crime isn't always what a real investigation looks like. So we have this idea that investigations happen really quickly, and that the cops can solve these cases in a matter of kind of days or a couple of weeks, whereas in reality it can take months and sometimes years, especially in very complex cases. So we think we know what the criminal justice system looks like and how it deals with cases, but actually we don't. We're only seeing the kind of the stylized version of that through the true crime medium.
And it sounds like a joke at first, but we've actually been watching for, I think, like over 20 years of Law and Order television show, the Law and Order television show, which literally tells us it's Monday and then the case ends on like Thursday. It tells you
Right.
that. There's a title card that says like Monday, Tuesday, and it goes
Right.
through the entire criminal justice process in about a week or a week and a half.
Yeah, so that's not realistic.
But think about how long people have been watching that show and the different variations of that show.
Right. But so they watch it and they ingest it and they get the wrong idea of the legal system ultimately.
Right. I mean, since we've been doing this, I've been waiting for those sound those the dun, dun, I've been waiting for that to just happen in my life, just
There
as
it is.
a
Bing.
There we
Yeah.
go.
We are in a really interesting, sorry, we are in a really interesting era for true crime, though, and I think that true crime podcasts have actually played quite a significant role in this. So I've recently done a piece of research with another couple of colleagues that I work with about the serialized true crime podcasts. So things like Serial, things like In the Dark, things like Missing and Murdered. These true crime podcasts that look at particular cases, often we're used to having an ending in true crime. So if we think of traditional true crime, the cops catch the bad guys, they send them to prison, everybody can sleep safe in their beds, and all is well and good with the world. But through the true crime podcasts, especially things like Serial, we've started to see the end of the ending. So we get to the end of these series, and we don't know who did it. We don't know who was responsible. There are often more questions than there are answers. So true crime, I think it's starting to look very different from how it used to be. And I think web sleuthing is in part today anyway, a kind of response to shifts in that true crime. So we've got what some criminologists call the vertigo of late modernity. So we live in times of uncertainty where we don't have definite answers, and we're learning to cope with that. So we saw the financial crash of 2008. We see kind of instability in society, and we're not sure kind of what's going on and who to believe, and fake news and all of this stuff. And we start to kind of gather around these spaces of precariousness. And I think web sleuthing is a manifestation of that. So we're uncertain, and we don't like being uncertain. So we go and hang out with other people who are uncertain, who help us kind of resolve it ourselves, because the actual show itself hasn't given us the answers.
Interesting,
What
yeah.
was that again? The vertigo. Every time we talk, I'm like, I'm just, I my IQ just goes up like half a
So
percent.
there's a really well-known criminologist called Jock Young, and I'd recommend any of his work to anyone who's interested in delving a bit deeper into this. So he talks about the vertigo of late modernity. He talks about uncertainty in contemporary society, and how we cope with that uncertainty, and how we make those dividing lines between the criminal and the law-abiding, and ourselves and the other. And how those lines have become increasingly blurred in recent times, and we have this kind of state of anxiety about it. So anything by Jock Young is definitely worth a read for any budding criminologists.
Noted. Thank you. Thank you.
One question I had about TV, sort of about what we were just talking about, and Law and Order, and how that's not really a realistic vantage point of the legal system. Is there any show that you know of, like fiction or otherwise, that actually is useful for web sleuths? Like, one that comes to mind for me is Forensic Files. Like that one, I feel like, I mean, almost like if you were going to go out there and commit a murder, it's useful though, because you know what not to do. Like all these little things get people in trouble or caught. But is there anything out there that people could use as a guide to learn a little bit?
I think I would check out any of the recent documentaries around crime that have been made by ITV in the UK. So they've recently had a series specifically looking at different types of crime. And there was one by a very well-known news presenter in this country called Trevor McDonald. And he looked at the murder of a woman called Alice Ruggles, who was murdered by her former partner, who'd been stalking her for quite a significant period of time. And I felt that the coverage of that case really did highlight some of the realities of investigations, especially around domestic homicide and stalking and coercive control and some of those things. So that was a really, really useful series of programs that went out recently. And yeah, I think what people really need to do is get a really broad range of stuff that you're looking at, whether that's true crime or whether that's crime drama, because we find that the dividing line between fact and fiction has become increasingly blurred and uncertain in recent times. And we've started to see the rise of the docudrama. So we've got cases that are real cases, but they're told to us in a kind of dramatic way, and the parts are played by actors. And I think that makes things really, really interesting. So we've had a few of those in the UK recently. There was one, I can't recall the exact name of it, but it looked at the Rochdale sex abuse scandal in the north of England, where there was a group of individuals who were preying on young girls for many, many years. And that was dramatized. I've just remembered what that's called. It was a docudrama called Three Girls. And that was really good. And I think that's available on the BBC iPlayer. But just get as broad a look at crime and representations of crime as you possibly can. And it's seeing these kind of things through a really critical lens. So all of the time be asking yourself, so what are the implications of this? How is this presenting a particular group of people to me? And what isn't it showing you? So what groups of people aren't being covered by crime television? Who are the people who are being left behind? Because we've talked about this before, haven't we? The tendency of media to tell us all about crimes that affect particularly women, particularly white middle-class women, but we don't tend to hear very much about young black men, about groups of people who are kind of runaways and throwaways, people who might have been involved in the residential care system. We don't really hear their stories because they're not considered to be ideal victims. We don't give them as much sympathy as we give to other groups. So see it as much as you possibly can, a really wide range of crime TV and true crime, and always ask those critical questions. What is it not telling me, as well as what is it telling me?
There's an interesting graph here, reported motives for web sleuthing, and this really kind of runs the gamut. This is all over the place.
Right. And I think what you had just closed with there by saying, look at, look at every avenue and also take a look at yourself and why. And this is a good segue to that. Why are you doing this? And are you actually like really look at yourself? Are you actually doing it for justice, or are you doing it for ego?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the one piece of pie that I don't see here, is like attention or ego. And obviously it's reported motives. So no one, very, very few people are going to say that's why. But I wonder what that slice really looks like here of this pie graph, how big that slice would be.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So we came across a whole range of different motives. So some people were saying that I'm doing this because I want to help achieve justice and closure. I want to uncover new leads or information. Others were saying, well, I've been a victim of crime myself. I've been affected by this type of case. Other people were just fascinated with a particular case. They'd become kind of obsessed with it. Others had this desire to help the victim or help their family. And some people felt a sense of proximity to the case. So even if they didn't know the people involved, they felt like the people involved could be their mother or their sister or their brother. This could have happened to my family. And that was what compelled them to get involved in it. And highlighting wrongful convictions or injustices was another one of the reasons that cropped up as well. So there's a whole host of different reasons that draw people in, that get people interested in doing this in the first place. And I think, and we'll find this out in the piece of research we're doing at the moment, hopefully, as to where the motive evolves over time. So do people get involved in web sleuthing around a particular case because they're just fascinated by it? And as they get deeper into it, they become quite kind of committed to it, and they develop that sense of justice, and they develop a sense of proximity to the people involved and want to help them. So we're really interested in how motive evolves, because we don't think it's something that stays static. We think it changes over time.
Interesting. I think you're right there.
Yep. That's yep. This is really important information for the people who listen to your show, who listen to Crawl Space and Missing More Murray. And it's a question that Tim and I ask ourselves a lot. And we ask of the people that we're in communication with who are, you know, part of the group of web sleuths that we work with. And even now the question isn't fully answered as to the why. Mm-hmm. Why are we doing it?
No, you're right. It changes.
It changes.
Perfect answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you don't have an answer, but other than, wow, it's just gone so far, it'd be a shame to stop, you know?
I guess, yeah. I mean, it's true. It's a real thing.
We're very fortunate to have someone like yourself and your colleagues and David Wilson to, like I said, kind of pull away all of the fabric of the why and where it comes from. And it's a really fascinating look into this like world
phenomenon.
Yeah, this like interwoven go ahead, because I don't know what I'm
and
saying
we're one of the things that we're also interested in is why do people stop doing it. So we were speaking the last time we Skyped together about people who just kind of moved away from a case, who just gave up and said, right, I've had enough, no more. And we're interested in finding out what is that? What is the thing that makes people walk away from something and say, actually, no, I'm not going to be involved in this? And the different ways in which people exit from cases. So people who gradually kind of peter out and go from, you know, looking at something every day to looking at something every other day, and they just kind of wander away, to people who just say overnight, right, that's it, I've had enough, I'm not doing this anymore. So we're fascinated to see what's going on there as well.
My guess is it would be a rift in the group that they investigate with.
Yeah, that could probably be the case.
More
of
a personal thing, I think.
And
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's that they have. They've so emotionally invested themselves in a particular theory, and once a member of that group has gone against that theory, I think that is probably the biggest reason why they would remove themselves. But also, it'd be interesting to see who comes back after removing themselves and what brings them back.
All of them?
Right. Was it something in the case, or was it something that another group member said? It's really... Again, it's really an onion that is just keeps on. My metaphors today are horrible. I'm sorry.
It's an onion that we're fascinated with.
Yes.
That we continue to be fascinated with. Well, the podcast is Crime Bites. Thank you very much, Liz, for joining us here today. We will be talking to you soon again, I'm sure, without a doubt. We really enjoy these conversations and the work that you and David and your colleagues do. And, you know, we feel connected to that work. So we want to keep talking to you as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And we really love listening to your podcast as well, because I think often a lot of the issues that we look at as criminologists, when I listen to one of your shows, they're all there and they're all out there and they're in the open, and you're looking at it in a really interesting way. So yeah, we're looking forward to working with you again.
And if you want to give the name of the article again, and maybe the three other co-authors that you had.
Yeah, so our article was called What's the Deal with Web Sleuthing? And that was published in the journal Crime Media Culture at the end of 2016. And my co-authors on that particular piece of research are Dr. Adam Lyons, Professor David Wilson, and Emma Kelly.
Awesome.
Great. Thank you very much, Liz. When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.